Offline is brought to you by Thrive Market. Simplify your grocery routine with Thrive Market. Its membership-based online grocery platform eliminates the hassle of traditional shopping by letting you filter curated products by your specific dietary needs and wellness goals, delivering exactly what you need right to your door. Thrive Market restricts 1,000-plus ingredients, no stressing over labels or Googling every additive. Every product is curated, organic, and non-GMO brands vetted before they ever hit the site. 90-plus dietary filters mean the label reading is already done for you. High protein, low sugar, GLP-1 friendly, gluten-free, dye-free, and more. The in-app barcode scanner finds a healthier swap for almost anything in your pantry. Great for summer party cleanouts. At $5 a month, the membership pays for itself. Most members make it back in their first two orders. No pre-order delivery fees, service charges, or tip math. One annual cost. They have some great, their popcorn's good. It's called Lesser Evil Popcorn. Love that. They have Simple Mills crackers, which are delicious. They've got Primal Kitchen sauces, if you're into that. They also have some fantastic tortilla chips. If you're ready to build your summer cart, join Thrive Market with my link, thrivemarket.com/offline, for $20 off your first three orders, plus a free gift. That's thrivemarket.com/offline.
For a limited time, you can get a Big Mac meal for just $8. That's a burger, fries, and a drink. They don't call it an extra value meal for nothing. Get a Big Mac meal only at McDonald's.
Price and participation may vary. Promotion pricing may be lower than meal pricing.
We've all been conditioned to market logic. We're like, look, we all have to be positive contributors in the market economy. And like, if you become obsolete, then you must reskill yourself. And like, now everyone's going to become a welder, electrician, or whatever. And it's bullshit. You know, it was bullshit when we said the coal miners were going to become coders. It's bullshit now. Like, it's bullshit when we said the factory workers are going to become nurses. Like, it's bullshit now when we say college grads are all going to become handymen.
Right.
Especially when 60% of college graduates are women. And 2.8% of electricians are women. So it's like, you look at that math and be like, oh, what's going to happen here?
I'm Jon Favreau, and you just heard from today's guest, Andrew Yang. You might remember Andrew's 2020 presidential campaign, where he came from nowhere to end up on the Democratic primary debate stage, mostly based on his universal basic income proposal to give every American a monthly $1,000 check. He also spent that campaign warning people that AI was coming to take all of our jobs. Well, here we are. Yang was unsuccessful in that campaign, but it turns out he was ahead of his time on AI. So when I heard he was in LA, I wanted to invite him on to talk about how he sees AI now, whether he still thinks his old UBI proposal is the right way to deal with the coming job displacement, and how our political system should deal with it all. You might also remember that after his 2020 bid, Yang left the Democratic Party to start the Forward Party, the goal of which is to elect independent-minded candidates and reform the electoral system. So I wanted to dig into that as well and get his thoughts on the Democratic Party as it stands today. We also talked about his new book of essays, Hey Yang, Where's My $1,000? And for fun, why he's decided to join the cast of a new television game show, Nation's Dumbest. It was a fun, freewheeling conversation that I hope you'll find interesting. We'll get to it in a moment, but before we do, if you're not yet a paying member to Friends of the Pod, what are you doing? In addition to it being the best way to support your favorite pro-democracy independent media company, becoming a paying subscriber gets you access to this show ad-free, as well as ad-free episodes of all your favorite podcasts. Plus, Friends of the Pod get access to special behind-the-paywall shows like Pod Save America Only Friends, Dan Pfeiffer's Polar Coaster, and our least offline podcast, Terminally Online. Head on over to crooked.com/friends to subscribe today. All right, here's Andrew Yang. Andrew Yang, welcome to Offline.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
All right, I got to start with The Nation's Dumbest.
Yes.
Because I have watched the first episode.
What a place to start.
So for people who don't know, you are a contestant on a new reality slash game show called Nation's Dumbest, along with celebrities like Carmen Electra, JoJo Siwa, Steve-O from Jackass. It's currently airing Wednesdays at 9 p.m. on Fox.
Yes.
So it's a series of trivia challenges where the winner each week gets to leave the show.
Yep.
And then the last contestant standing is The Nation's Dumbest.
Yes.
One episode has aired. You did not win the first week.
Yes.
I know you can't. Well, you were close. You were with one of the final two.
Oh, thank you for watching.
I know you can't divulge what happens tonight, Wednesday, though people will be hearing this episode on Sunday. How are you feeling about doing the show now that the first episode has been out in the world?
Well, thanks for asking, John. I did get a bunch of text messages being like, hey, I'm seeing you on TV at this show that is not your usual activity. I feel good about it because I made friends with Ice-T and Steve-O and Dr. Drew and Matt Leinart and a bunch of the other contestants because you're trapped. It's sort of an intense environment. Hilaria Baldwin asked me, have I been on a reality TV show before? And then I said, only if you count running for president. And then everyone got a laugh out of that. so it's been a good experience. The best part is that I watched the first episode with my kids who are 10 and 13. And it was one of the few things we've come together and watch as a family. And the kids were like, oh, you didn't know that or you didn't know that. And so like that was actually a joy.
I know I watched with my six-year-old and he had a few answers.
Like, yes.
He knew some. The trivia is... It's interesting. It's maybe like middle school level trivia, but some of it is harder than you think. Like yeah. there were questions that I got, but I was like, if I was there under all the pressure, I could see myself fucking that up.
Well, thank you for understanding, John, because it's true. You're surrounded by these floodlights and there are 20 camera people and they're like, Yang. Like, I'm going to describe this exercise. what is it? I'm just like, oh, man.
That was a hard one.
Thank you for saying so.
Do you feel extra pressure on the show? Because I feel
supposed to not be a dumbass. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Which I appreciate.
I feel like they like sought you out to try to, I don't know, like, because they have, you know, some people you don't expect to be that smart. You're on there and some of the other contestants are like, you're the presidential candidate. You better get this right.
Yeah, I certainly did feel some more pressure. And I joke that my career will be over if I wind up being the nation's dumbest officially, like losing to everybody. But I realized first they reach out to me and I have a call with the producers asking them, why me for the show? And they said, we're looking for a politician or journalist that people don't hate, which was very flattering.
Yeah.
Think you'd be good for this. It's like, are you smarter than a fifth grader? And I realized that if I turned it down, it was primarily because I would be uncomfortable with it or daunted by it. I wouldn't be turning it down for the right reasons. You know, I had some friends saying, don't do it. You're going to look dumb. It's going to be bad for your image. And I was like, these are not excellent reasons to say no. Like it feels like I'd be wussing out. So I said yes. I definitely had second thoughts during some of the tapings about that decision and major life decisions that preceded it. But now, you know, watching it as a family, it's actually been really fun. And different friends have gotten a kick out of it.
Look, my co-host and co-founder, John Lovett, went on Survivor. And only lasted one episode. And that is the greatest gift of content to me and to Tommy.
That would be the gift that keeps on giving. You show that clip over and over again.
somewhat serious question about it. Like, I've heard you say that one reason you thought the show was worth doing is that, you know, a primetime network audience reaches a lot more people than political shows like this, or at least a different audience than those shows. How do you think about getting attention and what kind of attention is valuable, or is it all valuable? Because as a presidential candidate who came out of nowhere and ended up where you did, you clearly figured out something about how to capture people's attention at a time when it's become an incredibly scarce resource.
Yes. That's why I have a thriving consultancy on that very thing. No, I don't. Yeah, I say, and I wrote this in my Substack, I say yes to doing podcasts that are much less cool than this one. I mean, this is like a real one. And I knew that a couple million people minimum were going to watch this Fox reality TV show. And when I ran for president, it's funny, John, you know when you're on a needle mover, and because people on the street will say to you like, hey, I saw you on this or I heard you on that. And you're like, oh, that one actually reaches normal people.
Yeah.
And then there are a lot of things you do that just disappear immediately.
Right.
And so I thought, well, look, this is going to get in front of millions of people. And I've been in Iowa and Ohio and Michigan. And a lot of those people are not tuning into like political news.
Right.
But that server at the diner could be like, hey, saw you on this, saw you on that. And so it felt valuable in that way, because I think one of the issues we have is the fragmentation of media and the siloing and the polarization, everything else. So if you could reach someone just trying to relax at home with their kids, like after a hard day's work, I thought that was a win.
The thing you got attention for during your 2020 presidential run was your prediction that automation and AI were coming for millions of jobs, and people treated you like, in your words, the magical Asian man from the future.
Yes.
Now, you know, Dario Amodi says it, Sam Altman, Bernie Sanders. Why do you think your prescient warning wasn't taken more seriously back then?
Well, I don't knock anyone or blame anyone, because back then saying artificial intelligence was going to come seemed kind of like Terminator or, you know, sci-fi. And now it's very much with us. I I came here in a Waymo. I don't know what that says about me. Anyone out here, like, ridden or not ridden?
I've ridden in one, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
They're everywhere here.
And I feel like a lot of my stuff in 2019, 2020 aged very well, a little bit too well. And when I get asked now, it's like, hey, how are you feeling? I feel really, really despondent that we are in the place we are. I think this is going to be terrible for many, many Americans. It's going to suck up tons of value into this super vortex of AI, capital, data centers, processing power. And millions of Americans are going to look up being like, what happened to my job? Why is my kid home from college and doesn't have a job that requires a degree? And it makes me angry and sad on behalf of those families. I'll be a little more lighthearted for a sec. I was with Dave Chappelle, who introduced me and said, here's a guy who got everything right in 2020, but no one listened because he's Asian, and then got a laugh. I made the case that I made to the best of my ability. And now the truth is that I feel more troubled by our institutional inability to respond to the problems of our time than I do anything else.
Yeah, and especially true around AI. I mean, there is some debate still over the scale of the job loss that's coming.
Oh, yeah. And the speed. We're gonna debate it even as they fucking disintegrate beneath our feet. You know what I mean?
Well, that's...
laugh because it's terrible.
You know, I think you said back in February, you think that millions of white-collar workers are going to lose their jobs in the next 12 to 18 months due to AI. You know, the data sort of tells a couple different stories. Yale's Budget Lab has been tracking this monthly, and they show 55,000 explicitly AI-attributed layoffs last year. That represents just under 5% of all layoffs. On the other end of the spectrum, Stanford finds employment for young workers in AI-exposed jobs down 13 to 20%. Even that larger number measures the problem in tens of thousands. So if you think like millions are coming, are the numbers? What are the current studies and measurements missing?
Sure. The easiest people to fire are those you haven't hired yet. Mm. And I run a company, Noble Mobile. We have offline parties. I mean, people,
co-branding.
Yeah, we come back to that. Sure. And Noble Mobile has 100% not hired junior engineers and data analysts and other folks that we would have hired just a few months ago because of AI. And if you extrapolate that through the economy, Noble Mobile is not a huge company, but there are millions of companies like us who are each saying, you know what, I don't think I am going to hire that whippersnapper. Instead, I'm going to have this person use AI tools. And that's happening 100%. I mean, we're here in Los Angeles, and I think there are a combination of things that are happening to LA, but I would argue that AI is one of the forces that's hurting media production and like studios and folks who used to show up to work and like shooting these studio lots every day. So I'm very happy to be the guy who's like, look, I think it's millions, and then have that conversation. And if someone comes to me later and is like, yo, Yang, it was really only 700,000, ha ha, then
it'd
be
the
like,
millions weren't until 5 years from now.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, oh, you screwed up by 18 months, you know, because there are so many people who have been right there saying we're going to decimate a bunch of jobs, who now have changed their tune. And they haven't changed their tune because they actually think differently. It's because they've been told, yo, stop freaking people out. Like, people are very negative on AI. The approval rating I saw was 26%. It's like incredibly unpopular. Two different people threw a Molotov cocktail and shot at Sam Altman's house. And so there genuinely was a coming together where they were like, we have to stop freaking people out about job loss. Everyone, then like the CEO of Goldman Sachs writes a New York Times op-ed being like, everything's going to be fine. Meanwhile, I talked to someone internal at Goldman Sachs who's like, oh yeah, we're going to fire 40% of our own people. So, you know, who do you want to believe? It aggravates me. So many people are full of it on this because they'll say one thing in public and then you know the organization's doing something different.
Well, then the other argument you hear is, yes, the transition's going to be rough, and transitions between, you know, economic revolutions often are, but what happens is new jobs are created where old jobs disappear. What's your level of confidence that that also happens this time around, or is this a transition that is different than industrial to post-industrial to information economy and all that?
Yeah, this time it is different. It's going to be terrible. And, I have numbers that I can attach to these things if people are interested. I'll throw one number out there. There may be 2.9 million Americans who work in call centers doing customer service still to this day. And AI is going to do a number on that. We can see that very, very clearly. And then imagining that those people are going to get reskilled to what exactly? Like, no one really knows. You then look at the 2 to 3 million Uber drivers, and maybe it's like a partial income, but still, they might be keeping their family afloat. Those are the obvious ones. There are a bunch of inobvious ones ripping through various orgs. And I think the entire comparison industrial revolution is very, very limited and dumb, honestly. I mean, but I hear it all the time. You're kind of strawmanning it too.
Yeah.
Because we've all been conditioned to market logic. We're like, look, we all have to be positive contributors in the market economy. And like, if you become obsolete, then you must reskill yourself. And like, now everyone's going to become a welder, electrician, or whatever. And it's bullshit. You know, it was bullshit when we said the coal miners were going to become coders. It's bullshit now. It's bullshit when we said the factory workers are going to become nurses. It's bullshit now when we say college grads are all going to become handymen.
Right.
Especially when 60% of college graduates are women. And 2.8% of electricians are women. So it's like, you look at that math and be like, oh, what's going to happen here? It's like, is everyone just going to change who they are so that, you can sense where I am on this particular topic.
Offline is brought to you by Quince. Summer days are always a little more relaxed. So when I open my closet, I find myself reaching for the same comfortable go anywhere pieces again and again. That's why I keep coming back to Quince. They focus on well-made essentials that naturally become those everyday staples you live in all season long. Quince's 100% European linen pants and shirts are breathable, easy to throw on in the summer upgrade your rotation needs, starting at just $34. Their tees are so soft, you'll never want to take them off, and the lightweight cotton sweaters are exactly what you want when summer nights cool down. In fact, I just got a couple of their t-shirts and one of their lightweight cotton sweaters. I was on vacation in Maine where it gets cold at night, but then it's warm during the day. So I had the sweater, the tees. Both of them are like super soft, very affordable. Really love Quince. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen. So you're paying for exceptional quality, not brand markup. Make your summer wardrobe easier. Go to quince.com/offline for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/offline for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/offline. Offline is brought to you by bookshop.org. Local bookstores are the heart of our communities. Since 2020, bookshop.org has funneled over $40 million back into independent shops. They're a Best for the World Cup B Corp and the unapologetic anti-Amazon alternative, built to ensure your favorite local bookstore stays open forever. Would you be surprised to learn that we're living in a resurgence of independent bookstores? More than 1,000 new stores have opened in the last 5 years. Independent bookstores do more than sell books. They take care of and pour back into their communities, creating safe spaces that foster culture, curiosity, and a love of reading. When you purchase from bookshop.org, you're supporting more than 3,000 local independent bookstores so they can continue their essential work. Now you can support local independent bookstores even when you read digitally with bookshop.org's ebook app. Download the app for iPhone or Android. Every purchase financially supports local independent bookstores. My favorite local independent bookstore, Chevalier's, is in Larchmont. Go there all the time. Take the kids there. they like to look at some of the books there, and then we buy them some books. I get to look at the books. It's like a really important store in the community in our neighborhood where we live, and we just love it. So I'm such a fan of independent bookstores, and bookshop.org really makes it easy to find one and support them. Use code OFFLINE10 to get 10% off your next order at bookshop.org. That's 10% off at bookshop.org with code OFFLINE10. So the question is what to do about it. You've talked about how it's time to stop taxing labor and start taxing AI.
Yep.
What does taxing AI look like to you? Token tax, payroll tax equivalent? Like what's the, there's a bunch of different proposals out there.
Yeah, I like a token tax. I think it's very direct and measurable. I like a value-added tax, and we're the only major economy that doesn't have one. It's very hard to game your way out of if you're a major company. It would include AI in the data centers. And more and more value is going to flow towards these global tech companies, and we're not going to see meaningful tax revenue. So that's really the problem to solve. If you solve that, then you can get more of the value into people's hands. I mean, the economy might be $31 trillion. Now AI is going to grow the top line. It's just the issue is that most people are not going to feel those benefits in a meaningful way. So there are two mechanisms. One is how do you get the tax revenue? And number two, how does that family feel like it's going to benefit them?
And do you think, so obviously, you know, your big proposal is universal basic income.
Yes.
$1,000 a month.
Yep. Freedom dividend, might have to ratchet that up a little
bit. I was going to say, so that was my next question. Like, what is UBI still the answer? Is it the only answer? Like, how if you're we're taxing these AI companies now, then what do we do with it?
We should distribute it quickly and broadly to the American people. And I'll tell a story, which I don't think it's in my book, which I appreciate you listening to.
Of course.
And have you written a book, John?
I have.
I thought so.
I have.
So did you get a note from your publisher saying, hey, AI wants to absorb your book into the Borg and they want to pay you $2,500 for the privilege? Did you get that letter?
I didn't get that yet. Unless someone got it that I didn't. I don't think I got it. It might have been right before. Yeah, not yet.
So the point is that our data right now is getting sold and resold for about $300 billion a year. And no American seeing a dime of that. AI models are now the foundation of these multiple trillion-dollar companies that are IPOing. And most Americans are not going to see a dime of that unless they somehow get access to the IPO, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so having that value get returned to the American people, if you think about it in those terms, it's actually very, very sensible. And it becomes increasingly necessary as all of this accelerates, would be my argument.
I'm just trying to think of like how this actually works, because right now the revenue of all of the AI companies combined is, you know, it's like what, a few hundred billion dollars globally. That's right now.
Yeah.
And so the worry is that the value from the companies comes after the jobs are
gone.
gone, right?
Yeah, totally.
And again, that like, you know, so UBI, that's your old proposal, that's $1,000 a month. That's like a, what, $3 trillion proposal a year?
Yes. It comes to a lot less than that because of existing benefits and a bunch of other things.
Right.
But let's say order of magnitude like that, that's what we're talking about. I think that's the kind of move that we should make. Right now, U.S. GDP might be $84,000 ahead. So if you think about something for each American to get, if you were to say $12,000 or $15,000, that might sound like a lot of money if you compare it to other things that we currently have coming out of the government. But if you compare it to $84,000 in GDP per person with an up arrow attached to it because of AI, you know, it's going to get to $90,000. It's going to get to $100,000. So at what point do you go to Americans and say, okay, you know, $100,000 ahead, everyone's getting $15,000, and that's going to help us manage the greatest economic and technological transformation in the history of our species.
Yeah.
You know, like that is what, I mean, that's what we're looking at right now.
I understand the political argument for a universal program like this. When we're talking a transformation of this scale and a problem this large, do you worry that handing out, you know, $1,000 a month or a couple thousand, whatever it scales up to people who are pretty wealthy is taking away resources that could be targeted to helping people through this transition in other ways than just giving them cash. Or maybe it's even giving people who need it more cash, or maybe it's not even the level of the amount of money. Maybe it's targeting it towards a specific group of people who are going to be more likely to be displaced by AI than other people.
Yes. All right, check it out.
Okay.
If you look at our history, the major other time where we saw this displacement was the Trade Adjustment Assistance, TAA, which mm-hmm. was meant to help the displaced manufacturing workers when we started kicking their jobs to Asia, let's say.
Yep.
And we were bad at actually targeting and delivering that at that time when you could actually point to the town in Ohio and say, okay, we're gutting this factory. Like, let's try and help people.
Yeah.
With AI, it would be very, very difficult to target in any intelligible way because, you know, you have a little company here, you have a big company there, you have folks, you know, never being hired. And so when you start looking at the difficulty of targeting and that any intelligent system is drawing in money from the big winners anyway, whether it's through a value-added tax or an AI tax, then you don't care. And using the most extreme example, it's like if Jeff Bezos gets an extra $2,000 a month, but we're bringing in, you know, tens of millions of dollars or more from either his company's activities or him personally, mm-hmm. then you don't care about sending the dude $2,000, especially if it eases the administration problem and it makes it seem fair, politically palatable, appealing to folks. We're just shitty at targeting the gains. And if you start trying to target, you end up in a TAA type problem. And I'd urge anyone who thinks that we can do this to go look at the history of what happened with the TAA program, because it did not go well. And that was easier to identify than what we're looking at now.
Yeah, you lose efficiency, and it's harder to target.
It's really sad when you actually see what happened with that program, the displaced manufacturing workers in Ohio and Michigan, where you had a giant waiting list of people to sign up, and they never end up getting benefits. And then even if they did get through the program, the impact wasn't what people hoped for.
Why tax and a check rather than ownership? Giving everyone ownership of the AI companies and the upside.
I'm open to anything.
Okay.
You know, it's like,
I know like some of the proposals too is like, everyone gets a little piece of the upside. And I don't know what you thought about that.
Yeah, no, I'm open to it. I think that one of the fears I have, I will say, and one reason I love starting a conversation with something like universal basic income, is that let's say that people via the government now become shareholders of some of these companies. And then we can all be like, yay, we got the shares. And then the stewards of that are like, okay, we're going to chill and see and wait. And then like I get rid of your jobs, but then I'm still not feeling any benefits, even though technically like my government, because we have, you understand it. Like
yeah.
we have two problems in this, you know, current environment. One is where's the value flowing in, and then how is it coming back out?
So then the other option that's sometimes seen as like an alternative to UBI is like redistributing work, right? And not just money. So there's job guarantees, shorter work week, work sharing, like they've done in Germany, wage insurance. What do you think about all those?
Again, I'm very, very open-minded. Hmm. And I love a shorter work week. Love that. The one I dislike the most is something like of a job guarantee, because I think you wind up with bullshit, make work jobs
and then
people justifying. Yeah, it's like, oh, so my joke with Bernie, we were talking about in 2020, he was for a jobs guarantee and I was for universal basic income. And my joke was, why not distribute gray overalls while you're at it and like a pickaxe? It's like, you know, it's like, that's where this lands. But I understand the spirit of it. And I do have an Asian joke here, which is like, I'm Asian, so I love work. I love people working. I just think people ideally are creating work for themselves, starting initiatives, organizations, nonprofits, working in their faith community, like doing things that they want to do and that they're passionate about. The big challenge of this era, John, is trying to define an economy around human flourishing at a time when our labor will not be meaningful in terms of economic output. And that's a very hard thing to actually accept.
Well, that it is. Then it's like the, but then I think like that the problem is so big that, I mean, unless we are giving people, you know, a $70,000-$80,000 a year salary through UBI, which is, I mean, that's incredibly, incredibly expensive. Like, how are we, like, is, do you see a future where like no one's working, like where like 90% of the labor is automated and AI is doing it? Like, how severe do you think it gets?
Yes. So I'm 51. And what I say to people is that I'm at an age where if I don't get dumber in a given month, it was a good month. Meanwhile, AI might get twice as smart during that month. So saying that, oh, if I like take this course or like, you know, do this, like I'm going to be able to compete is stupid. It's like the goalposts are just sprinting away from me
right.
by the time I even get to the starting block. Like, it's crazy.
Right.
So then after you accept that, then it becomes a question of, okay, like, how do we make it so that people have a place to go for structure, purpose, fulfillment, community, values, right. training? You know, when I wake up in the morning, what am I going to do?
Right.
And to me, the only satisfactory vision is that we make it so that I have a place to go based upon things that, A, I want to do, and B, that we need more of. And the three things that most of us can agree on in this dimension would be health and wellness, education, nurturing, and caretaking, mm-hmm. and arts and creativity.
Okay.
These are three things that most people can look at and be like, okay, like
Even AI won't completely eliminate the need for those things.
Well, here's the thing is that AI could, for example, do the art much better than I could. But that is not necessarily the point. Like we're going to redefine the economy.
This is more about personal fulfillment.
Yes. Like, these are things that we have decided we value as a society. Because right now, we're in this most dangerous of times, which is what we actually value as a society is just getting shit done, capital efficiency, and we've all brainwashed ourselves into, you know, like hustle mode and like grindy, yeah. and like, you know, I'm an ass, like, you know, all the stuff. And then if someone falls by the wayside, we have mock sympathy for them for like a split second, be like, oh, it sucks for them, and then be like, oh, well, you know, turn away. Yeah. Meanwhile, in this case, AI is going to get many, many more of us, and it has nothing to do with my intellect or education or work ethic or character. Just doesn't matter. You know, it's like it's better than me. And so what we have to do is we have to say, okay, AI is going to do a lot of work, and robots are going to do a lot of work very powerfully and effectively. So what do we care about? What do we want more of? What do we want to spend our time doing? So one of the illustrations I pose is that at this point, we should all be getting paid to go to the gym. You know, it's like instead of us paying, like, we should be getting paid. And then the personal trainer who's there all energetic there to whip us into shape and whatnot should also be getting paid.
Yeah.
And they could be paid in wellness bucks. And then they could take those wellness bucks and then, you know, use it on a salad or use it to go to the game or use it and they could get like recognized for the wellness bucks. And like we could get wellness bucks showing up.
Uh-huh.
And
who's paying us the wellness bucks?
So what we need to do, in my opinion,
yeah.
is build a multivariate human-centered economy
okay.
around multiple pursuits. And then if you have this wellness bucks as an example, the wellness bucks would be monetized by the federal government. If I was in charge,
okay.
I'd be like, look, there's an exchange rate whole thing. You can take wellness bucks and like turn them into stuff. You can go to Chipotle, like get a burrito. You can live great on the wellness bucks.
Yeah.
You can live well on the education and nurturing bucks. And the example I used on the trail is that we have an autistic son. My wife is spent years at home with him. The market economy values that at zero.
Right.
We all know that's perverse and that's immensely valuable. And so she could be getting like these nurturing bucks. I mean, we'd have a better name. They'd all be called Yang bucks, honestly.
Of course.
And then arts and creativity, if someone paints a mural or goes and performs live, which I love, like the, you know, the cafe or whatnot,
yeah.
instead of counting on the charity of strangers, which like, you know, it's very, I always, by the way, give money to any musician I pass, because I have a reputation to uphold and I'm like, the rest of it
could be a camera. Right?
But the government would say, look, this new currency is real. Everyone would doubt it at first. They'd be like, oh, like it's bullshit. But then after you have a bunch of people taking action on it and then realizing that they can carry a balance and do these things and even like trade it with each other and do it, you could stimulate billions and billions of dollars worth of activity in each of these dimensions that could occupy millions of Americans very happily and do it at a fraction of what it would cost if you were, you know, paying people in USD.
Okay. This is like a sort of a utopia that's sort of on the other side of the transition, right? Like, say we could get this.
Well, no, by the way, we have to get there as soon as fucking possible.
Well, that's what I'm saying. But
because this chasm in the middle is going to consist of us all freaking out, our kids coming home, getting depressed and dysfunctional, feeling they don't have a place in the world, and eventually we start killing each other. Well, that's not already there.
No, that's what I was getting at, is that like the transition, regardless of what's on the other side of the transition, is the most precarious part here because of politics, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, 80% of Americans want more regulation. You've got politicians from like Bernie Sanders to Ron DeSantis attacking data centers. I was thinking about something my old boss, Barack Obama, said to The New Yorker a couple months ago. He said he's been working on helping like lawmakers come up with like AI agenda that's not simply a knee-jerk screw the billionaires in tech thing because the genie's out of the bottle. And he said he worries that without a proactive agenda, some of the populist impulses could go in bad directions that don't actually help people or reinforce some of the anti-democratic trends we've seen. As usual with him, he's sort of understating the issue here. But it does seem like this could supercharge all of the political trends we have seen over the last decade in ways that are quite destructive. And I wonder how you think about sort of navigating that challenge.
Yeah, the path of least resistance is disintegration, conflict, strife, hatred, like the whole nine.
Yeah.
I am Asian. And so one of the things I joke about with my community is like, look, guys, we all know that when the wheel of hate turns, it will like, you know, land on us like relatively early on the list. And so we have to try and keep the country strong and whole and together and keep us from turning on each other. I think it's a noble ambition that Brock is laying out. But right now, let's take wealth inequality as like something I think we can all agree is driving nastiness and polarization, anger and frustration. Uh-huh. AI is going to supercharge it all.
Right.
I mean, anyone sane can see that. And so what you'd have in the best of worlds would be government acting as a counterweight, bringing the folks to the table and saying, look, guys, pitchforks are going to come. Let's try and figure this out. Like, we don't all want to be using Chinese AI. And by the way, I have an AI joke I'm going to share. It's fun.
Yes, sir.
How far behind the U.S. is China in AI?
How far?
12 hours, because they wake up and see whatever we did. All right. So.
That's good.
All right. So. So we need to have a grand bargain type approach. Mm. And even the folks I know at the AI companies, the argument is like, look, guys, this is just enlightened self-interest. Because even though you're sitting on stacks of money, bulletproof cars and private security and like the bunker and the rest of it, it sucks. Like, it's terrible. So how about you give some back and stay above ground? That's really the argument. And some of them are like, yeah, I'm down with that. Others have just said like, no, it's all going to shit. And like, I'm just going to, you know, monetize.
Right.
But you have to try and take advantage of the first group as quickly as you can.
Oof. Well, let's talk more about politics. You were a Democrat for most of your adult life. You ran for president as one. You left the party in October of 2021. What in your view is so wrong or broken with the Democratic Party that you didn't think it was worth changing it from the inside?
It was the math. Genuinely, I looked at it, was like, hey, you know, you have maybe 30 of the 50 states where the Democratic brand is quite underwater, mm-hmm. negative. And by the way, it's gotten a lot worse since 21. Mm-hmm. And so if you want some kind of genuinely dynamic, solutions-oriented environment, you need someone like Dan Osborne to become senator out of Nebraska. Mm. By the way, union guy, very like military veteran, pro-choice, like, you know, very reasonable, I think would be like a fine U.S. senator,
for sure.
You know, and yeah. got 47% in Nebraska as an independent, forced the Republicans to spend $10 million in a deep red state. So I'm sure they enjoyed it. I'm sure they enjoyed propping up Deb Fischer. so I looked at the math and the map and I said, the two-party system is going to get worse, not better. It's going to become more polarized and dysfunctional and not somehow right itself. Mm. And so the only way out would be to try to have a positive, independent political movement that can compete in ways that, a traditional partisan couldn't. And I experienced versions of this, John. So I'm walking around Iowa and say, hey, I'm running for president. And the waitress at the diner says, very, very intrigued. Like, oh, really? Like, what party? And I said, Democrat. And then she recoiled and was like, oh, it's like I just sprouted horns. And I was like, wait a minute. Like, aren't I for you? I mean, at least that's the way I was brought up.
Yeah.
So Dan Osborne's running again. You have Seth Bodnar running in Montana, mm-hmm. who was advised by John Tester, the last Democratic senator from Montana, who's like, hey, I think his direct quote was, the Democratic brand is poison in Montana, so run as an independent. And now Seth has raised seven figures and like poised to be potentially competitive.
But then the Democrat is still in the race.
Yeah.
Screwing the whole thing up.
Right. Well, and that is one of the points here is that like a lot of folks listening to this podcast think Democrat, and then any third party is a spoiler. But then if you look at a place like Montana, it really could be the reverse, where you Seth Bodnar one-on-one with the Republican, who, by the way, in this case is like not exactly a strong Republican, just like some weird last-minute replacement job.
Yeah. not beloved. Yeah.
Like you can compete there. But if you throw a D next to the candidate's name, you probably can't compete because, you know, and you can feel how you want to feel about that. But it's just math. It's practical. And so the question is, how can you make more of these environments genuinely dynamic and competitive? And I saw that in 2021 when I was just doing the research, and I'd urge anyone to take a look at some of the numbers, the electoral map, gerrymandering, number of competitive districts, Senate races, et cetera. And it's very hard for me to imagine a world where the Democratic Party, as it currently stands, gets a durable governing majority, solves all the problem, turns all the red states blue. it's actually trending the other direction because a lot of the biggest blue states are losing population. And so congressional seats are then like drifting the other direction. More and more rural areas are, I mean, I can stop there, but people kind of get it.
You are right about the brand and the math. The challenge I see is, like, I love that, you know, Dan Osborne can run in Nebraska instead of the Democrat, and then a bunch of people will think, oh, because there's not the D attached to his name, that maybe I'll give him a shot, even though all of his positions he could fit comfortably within the Democratic Party.
Yeah, a whole lot of them.
Most of them, right?
Yeah.
And even all of them, he wouldn't be kicked out, right?
Well, by the way, his big break from the party in terms of like the voters of Nebraska is he was like, look, I'm a pipe fitter. I'm a mechanic. I have tattoos on my arms. I don't even own a business suit. And like, I think that politicians should wear NASCAR jackets with the names of all their corporate sponsors on them,
right?
Because that's what's going on in Washington. And I was like, yeah. so like that's, you know, and that happens to be genuine in Dan's case, but I agree with you on his policy positions.
But the challenge is at some point, Republicans are going to get smart to this and figure out that if someone's not running with the D next to their name, but they have a lot of the D positions, that they're just a Democrat trying to fool you by shedding the party's brand. And like, it's, do you see the Forward Party as a party that people join and support because they see their political beliefs reflected in the party, or like some third parties? Is it just a home for people who hate the other two parties, the two major parties?
We are political infrastructure for positive, principled independence.
But what does that mean? What positions, what beliefs? Because everyone has like, and you know this, right? Like it's a Seth Bodnar and a Dan Osborne has a different platform than a Bloomberg, right?
Yeah.
Right? There's like the socially liberal, fiscally conservative independent. There's the culturally conservative, economically populist independent.
do they both have a home in the forward party? Is it just everyone who's not completely ideologically left and ideologically right?
Well, we have principles around being data-driven, solutions-oriented, rule of law, listen to vote totals, hear the Constitution, some of the basics. But it's also collaborate with people from either party or any party. Don't demonize, don't villainize. I think those three figures you named, obviously Dan Osborne and Seth Bodnar, sure. But we'd be perfectly happy with a Mike Bloomberg as well, even though he might differ very significantly from Dan Osborne in various economic issues. The point we would make is that right now, our current system is not going to deliver what the majority of Americans want. And so how do we get ourselves to a place where it will? And in my view, that starts with having, dynamic U.S. Senate that in this case might have two or three principled independents from South Dakota, Montana, and Nebraska, instead of it being, run by, in this case, the Republican Party. And I think that's more achievable than most Americans realize, that if you had one or two of these independent Senate candidates break through, it would be a very, very big deal for our national politics. By the way, to your point, I just wanted to say, you know what the Republicans spent that $10 million on in Nebraska? Saying Dan Osborne's a Democrat. So to your point, that's like the attack line. It's like, he says he's an independent, he's lying to you, he's just a Democrat. And then, anyway.
But it also, it works in Nebraska because the Democrats are bowed out, or is bowing out, this, right? Like, we're not going to have this, we're not going to have a situation we had in Montana, right? The situation in Montana is because Republicans are all, enthralled to Trump, and it's a Trump party, and everyone's and they're all cohesive, and so they're, at least for now, they're one party. And in Montana, the Republican's going to win because the Democrat won't drop out, and Seth's in the race. And so then they split the vote, the Republican wins, and then it's like, whose fault is that? Is it the independent candidate, the Democratic candidate, both? Everyone for not being able to figure it out? Like, I'm just wondering if both the Democratic Party and the Forward Party are put at a disadvantage because the Republican Party has unity and can take that partisan Republican voters, but other voters who might be sick of the Democratic Party brand, interested in being more independent, will split the vote, and then it will end up to the benefit of Republicans.
So Dan Osborne being one-on-one with Deb Fischer is not a one-time thing. Yeah. In 2022, just 2 years before, Evan McMullen got a one-on-one with Mike Lee,
right?
Because the Democratic candidate in Utah was like, "Hey, look, I'm going to give it to Evan. Like, I got a shot."
Right.
And that Democrat, I think knew Evan. Like, it was kind of coalitional. It was like a good energy and a good vibe. Mm. In South Dakota, Brian Bangs, who ran for U.S. Senate as a Democrat in the last cycle, and now is running as an independent, said, "Hey, I will agree with the Democratic candidate that whichever one of us is polling weaker gets out and supports the other." Huh. The other thing I'm going to just say from the starting gate is, like, no one thinks Montana is going to be competitive in the absence of, like, an independent candidate. Same with South Dakota. I mean, these are just red blotches on the map to the vast majority of folks. But if you get to those states, you realize that it's not like everyone loves the Republicans there. And it's not like everyone loves their electeds in D.C. I mean, a lot of them hate them. It's like, if you decide you just want to play the current game, then you're just giving the Republicans uncontested wins in various places. And so at least if Seth runs and he can work it out with the Dem, at least you have a chance. Like, we're introducing possibilities where there would be none otherwise.
Offline is brought to you by 3-Day Blinds. There's nothing I'd rather be talking about right now than blinds. Blinds, blinds, blinds. There's a better way to buy blinds, shades, shutters, and drapery, and it's called 3-Day Blinds. They are the leading manufacturer of high-quality custom window treatments in the U.S. We can shop for almost anything at home. Why not blinds? 3-Day Blinds has local, professionally trained design consultants who have an average of 10-plus years of experience that provide expert guidance on the right blinds for you in the comfort of your home. Just set up an appointment, and you'll get a free, no-obligation quote the same day. DIY projects can be fun, but measuring and installing blinds can be a big challenge. The expert team at 3-Day Blinds handles all the heavy lifting. They design, measure, and install so you can sit back, relax, and leave it to the pros. Also had 3-Day Blinds, by the way, even before they were a sponsor. When I first moved to LA, got 3-Day Blinds, and because I don't know how to install blinds or really pick them out, someone came, they helped me out, walked me through the whole process step by step, and it was fantastic. 3-Day Blinds has been in business for over 45 years, and they've helped over 2 million people get the window treatments of their dreams, so they are a brand you can trust. Right now, get quality window treatments that fit your budget with 3-Day Blinds. Head to 3dayblinds.com/offline for their buy one, get one 50% off deal on custom blinds, shades, and drapery. For a free, no charge, no obligation consultation, just head to 3dayblinds.com/offline. One last time, that's buy one, get one 50% off when you head to the number 3daiblinds.com/offline.
Your sausage McMuffin with egg didn't change. Your receipt did. The sausage McMuffin with egg extra value meal includes a hash brown and a small coffee for just $5. Only at McDonald's for a limited time.
Price and participation may vary. Promotion pricing may be lower than meal pricing.
I'm Nate Silver.
I'm Galen Druk.
And I'm Claire Malone.
We're back, this time with our friends at Crooked Media for a new show called
Still Counting.
Yeah.
Numbers are hard, takes are easy.
And frankly, numbers have only gotten harder.
What does the data actually say? How do we reconcile that with the other things that we're seeing in American politics and around the world? And how do we use that data to understand or maybe even dare to predict the future of American politics?
New episodes every Wednesday starting September 9th. Subscribe to Still Counting on youtube.com/@stillcountingpodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
So this is all sub-presidential level. What do you think about sort of 28 and the field that the Democrats might have in 28? What's your scouting report on the bench?
Oh, so fun. Are you a sports guy, John? Are we hitting it like
that? I have too much politics in my head, so I don't have space for all the sports stuff that I used to have.
I do like sports, but I get asked a lot about the candidates, and I know most of them, I'd say, in the Democratic field. I think it's going to be a governor who's not part of the Biden administration, is my feeling. And so that gives you Gavin Newsom, Josh Shapiro, Wes Moore, J.B. Pritzker, Gretchen Whitmer, if she decides to run. I think was there news on her not? I don't know. I mean, I thought Whitmer would be very strong.
She kind of ruled it out and then sort of walked it back, but it seems like she's not going to.
I think Americans are eager to move on from the Biden years. I shouldn't laugh. By the way, like, I want everyone to rewind the tape a little bit. And I think you were in on this, which I appreciate about you, because you have something called a brain. So
for now, it's
all right. So if people keep up with me, you know, I've not been a Trump fan from the get. Like, I decided to run for president because Trump won in 2016. I was like, oh my God, like, things are going to get more fucked up. it's time for me to get off my, my couch and do something about this. Fast forward to 24, Joe Biden's running. And I was like, this is a catastrophe. And so I get behind my guy, Dean Phillips, go up to New Hampshire being like, hey, it's primary time. Let's go, Dean. The new Dean scream. and watching the knives come out for Dean, like, really, really saddens me to this day, where this dude tried to save the party from itself, really. It's like, come on. Watching all the Democrats, A, fall over themselves to get out of Joe's way, and B, shiv Dean in the way that they did. It was just such a calamity and missed opportunity for the country. I mean, a lot of these governors I just listed would have been great candidates in 2024. If they had, like, you had a primary, and I think that's where the Democratic Party failed all of us. I'm angry about it every day to this day, you know? Yeah. And Dean lost his seat in Minnesota. And this is a guy who, like, you know, three-term member of Congress from a competitive district, lost his, lost his reputation. I mean, I'm not sure that's true, because his reputation kind of got vindicated. But there was, like, a parade of hit pieces and his colleagues being like, oh, like, this guy, terrible. And it's like, what are you talking about? Like, that this guy did what we wish everyone did, which is, like, put his career on the line for the country.
Well, I will say, so I was very much on the, like, I don't know about, this is not a great idea for Biden to run. And I was way more vocal
after
the debate. We had Dean on and gave Dean a hard time, but not because it wasn't like other people in the party was like, how dare you run against him? Because my frame to Dean was like, yeah, this is pretty scary that we're doing this. And it's like nice that someone's actually challenging him. But like, what are you off? Like, what's the choice? And I feel like it's indicative of a larger issue we have, which is we're all very good at talking about what's bad or what we don't like, but you can't beat something with nothing.
And What are we talking about here?
I think that in the Democrat, when I say this for the whole party, right?
Yeah, like, I know.
And I worry as much as like, I think that, and I know you have thoughts on Kamala Harris as well, but like, you know, she only had 104 days and all that, but it was very, okay, what do I have to, like, I want to win. I want to help the party. There's so much pressure on me, which like I totally get, but it was like, okay, what do I need to say? I know. And I, although the governors you talked about too, I sort of blame all of them too, because they could have run. They could have run before the debate. They could have not endorsed her and forced a primary afterwards. There was no time, so they didn't. I understand why, but like, it's really a collective problem here where at the end of the day, you need to, if you're going to run for president, and you need to, and we need someone who runs for president who's like going to be for something, and you understand immediately why they're running for president.
I'm with you. And I do remember you being one of the more lucid voices on like the, yo, guys, is this really the best approach? So.
What about you? You going to run?
I am.
I know you sound like you're leaning towards it when I've heard you.
Yeah, well, it's good, I guess. I mean, shoot. Leaning forward, Andrew Yang. Now, I did not run in 2024 because I did not think I would be constructive or helpful or generative. What I did do in 24 is go to New Hampshire and South Carolina and try and help Dean Phillips force a Democratic primary. I thought that was my highest use. It made me sad when you did it something above average just by having Dean on. I mean, you know, so thank you.
Yeah, we were on like a scale like, oh, you must not come on because you've done something horrible.
Yeah, no, I mean, he was like, you know, freaking, again, third term member of Congress, vice chair of the Democratic Caucus. I mean, he's a real dude.
Yeah.
So I thought that was my highest use. And the question now for me is like, what is my highest use? I try and ask myself that's like a, you know, like I have two missions, like, you know, how can I do the most good? And two, how do I stay married? And those like the two main things that motivate me at any given day.
Goes through my head. Make sure my kids still like me.
Yes. So the major question for me is how do I see things playing out and like, how can I be helpful?
If you did run, would you run as a Democrat?
I know, I have a lot of respect for a lot of the candidates who are currently in the field, but you know, like I can't say to you what I said earlier and then spend like, you know, the last number of years trying to build a political alternative and saying, you know, I think the answer is actually it's the Democratic Party again.
Well, I guess the thing that would worry me is I think the history of third party candidates on a presidential level, like the system just makes it impossible for them to win. Ross Perot got what, 18% of the vote, 90% of the vote, still got zero electoral votes. The only one who's ever gotten electoral votes is George Wallace because he was a factional candidate in one geographic area. So,
though if you do rewind the tape, I think Abraham Lincoln technically was a third party candidate. that is also part of our history. But what you're asking right now, John, is the sort of thing that someone like me weighs. It's like, you know, because I consider myself a do-gooder. Like, I want to do positive things. And so you have to figure out, hey, is this going to have a positive impact?
Right.
One of the reasons I ran for president in 2020 is that I thought I'd have a positive impact, win or lose. It's like, look, I'm going to let people know about the fourth industrial revolution and AI, mainstream universal basic income as something we need, hopefully accelerate the end of poverty in our time. Because poverty, we can alleviate it if we just decide to do so. I mean, it's fucking madness that we haven't. We are the richest, most advanced society in the history of the world, and AI is going to give us an unprecedented in human history chance to flip from scarcity to abundance. That's like the only big opportunity in this time. Like, is it going to make us crazy? Is it going to decimate our jobs? Like, yes. but it could also flip us to abundance. And so that is the project of this time. And I thought I could help us in 2020 move in that direction. win or lose. And when I was on programs like this, if someone was like, come on, Yang, like, do you really think you're going to win? Then I have to be like, of course, because, you know, if you say no, then you're a joke and like, people, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
So I don't know if this is you specifically, but what I'd say to people is like, there are multiple versions of victory. Hmm. If I thought that there were multiple versions of victory, I'd be much more enthused about running. Because the reality is I'm unlikely to actually be president. And I'm also not someone who's terribly motivated by that, though, in part because, you know, I'm like Asian, like son of immigrants, not like, like I'm going to be president someday. That's not a thing that was happening in the Yang household. it's more, you know, it's like, I love this country. Can I help it?
Are there any Democrats and the potential candidates now that you think come close to getting the AI story and the crisis and solutions? Like, is anyone talking about it in ways that you find compelling?
I think a lot of them get it. The question is, what are we going to do about it in what time frame? Mm. And that's something, you know, I'm more dubious of, truly, because one of the great diseases of this time, John, is that the political incentives and what happens to most people are now like more unrelated than they've been in our lifetimes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
and so my concern is that someone's going to win and then have various pressures coming in and then do some of the things maybe. And this is all assuming, by the way, that we have fair elections and the institutions hold up and like a lot of things you have to hold. But I'm someone who thinks that we should be distributing money to human beings right now. Like, I was sincere in 2020. It's like, look, at a minimum, we should be adopting a negative income tax and a revved up child tax credit so that more money is flowing to the needy among us and the numbers show it pays for itself.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that's going to happen with even some of my favorite people in this field winning.
Yeah.
I do like some of them, though.
Yeah. I want to end on one question that's just because it's the most offline topic of all. You now run a phone company, Noble Mobile, whose entire pitch is that it pays you to use your phone less.
It is very offline.
Thanks. Explain the model and the idea behind it. And you even have offline parties, which you referenced earlier.
Yes, offline parties where we put your phone in a bag and then you have to make eye contact with people. We actually had someone get someone's phone number on a napkin. They like walked out with like a napkin. It's like awesome. The 90s, man. You and I remember.
I know.
Like our college parties.
That's why this generation's going to solve it, because we've seen both. We've experienced.
We're the bridge
now. Yeah.
Wait, like you're a Gen Xer like me then?
I'm a millennial.
Oh, you're another millennial.
I'm 1981. So
like my wife was born in 81.
Okay. Yeah.
So yeah, you're a millennial.
There you go.
All right. So check it out. I'm the magical Asian man who's trying to give everyone money. Uh-huh. And then, and Americans are more frustrated than ever about our finances. So I saw what Mark Cuban did with Cost Plus Drugs. Have you had Mark on?
Actually, yes, we did.
I'm sure
Pfeiffer talked to him.
Yeah. Good. So Mark starts Cost Plus Drugs, which gets Americans a better deal on generic drugs. And I was like, Mark, that's freaking genius. Mm. And so I thought, can we get Americans a better deal on something else that we all pay for? So I listed the expense structure of the average American family and household, and it goes, you know this, housing, healthcare, education, food, fuel, transportation, media, and then wireless. Mm. We spend $83 a month on our wireless service. I was spending $140, $150 a month on Verizon just for myself. I'm a chump. I'm going to put you on the spot. I don't know if this has ever come up in the history of offline. Which provider do you use and how much do you spend? Do you know?
Verizon. And it's definitely up to like between 150 and 180.
Me too. Same.
It's a lot.
All right.
Because I have the automatic pay and I get the text message from Verizon. It's like, you've paid the bill this month. And I'm always like,
yes, every month. Yeah. I got it. It was like 154.74 was the number they kept texting me. All right. The average American spending $83 a month on their wireless. The average European is spending $35 a month on their wireless.
Oh.
Same stuff. That $48 a month delta comes to an extra $100 billion a year that Americans are spending on data that's really a commodity at this point. And one of the secrets in this industry is that you and I chose Verizon because it was the best network and we are a very special and important people. So we deserve the best. It was more expensive.
Yeah.
Over the intervening 20 some odd years or so, All of the three major carriers have now built very robust networks so that there's almost no difference between them.
Uh-huh.
So you and I are spending $150 a month on Verizon for like a brand that, you know, might have been true at some point, now less true. So I went to the carriers and was like, guys, who's going to give me, Andrew Yang and Scott Galloway and some other people, like the best value possible to distribute to the American people, like, you know, the Robin Hoods of mobile?
Yeah.
And T-Mobile said, we will. So T-Mobile is our backbone. We sit on their tower. We don't sit on their tower, but we use their towers.
Yeah.
And the average mobile user is spending $42 a month as opposed to $83 a month on unlimited wireless. I'm on it right now. I switched from Verizon. And here's the kicker, that any data you don't use, we give you half the money back at the end of the month. So that's the...
So you're using your phone less.
That's the gimmick of, if you use your phone less, we will pay you. And the average mobile user is using 17% less screen time than they did previously, which I'm going to say is probably realistic for a lot of people.
Because
I, like you, am a heavy phone user.
Mm-hmm.
But 15% less, it's like, yeah, I can do that. And by the way, the entire thing is psychological, because when you're doom scrolling and looking at stuff that's probably making you sad...
like John Favreau.
Now you're like, wait a minute, I'm actually costing myself money doing this. And then you're like, oh, let me stop.
Making me miserable and poor.
Yes. Villanueva, Mia Kelman,
so those are the two things we try and solve for with Noble, is save more money. And we pay 5.5% interest on any of the savings you get. And like Yang thinks that psychologically, if you have a growing balance, like it'll make you happier.
Yeah.
And then also doom scroll less, look up more, touch grass more, and that will make you happier. So Noble Mobile, you know, millions in revenue, like thousands of very, very happy customers. And anyone listening to this, if you go to noblemobile.com/yang, you get 3 months for free, which will save you $250 on average. So I'm still the magical Asian man from the future trying to give everyone money. And I don't even need to be president to do it.
Look at that.
Yes. So, you know, and this brand tie-in with Offline is, I got to say, perfect. We'll probably
I can't believe I didn't know about this before. But we love any kind of gimmick, any kind of strategy to get people off their phones, or at least use their phones less. So I'm glad we could end the conversation with that. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me, John. I really appreciate it.
Of course.
I'm Nate Silver.
I'm Galen Druk.
And I'm Claire Malone.
We're back, this time with our friends at Crooked Media for a new show called
Still Counting.
Yeah.
Numbers are hard, takes are easy.
And frankly, numbers have only gotten harder.
What does the data actually say? How do we reconcile that with the other things that we're seeing in American politics and around the world? And how do we use that data to understand or maybe even dare to predict the future of American politics?
New episodes every Wednesday starting September 9th. Subscribe to Still Counting on youtube.com/@StillCountingPodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.